Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Most of my contented clients are not exhausted at the end of most work days. They're just kind of pleasantly tired, but they've got enough energy for a fulfilling life after work. But I do have other clients who say they need a lot of downtime to recharge. So they do things like meditate and they knit. They play video games. Those kind of approaches, they treat the symptom, not the disease. And when I probe them, it often gets clear that the client can change one or more of these things so that their workday doesn't drain them so much. There's going to be like about a dozen things that I'll try to tick off, and then I will certainly invite you to call in and tell me about your situation at work, either your exhaustion or how you've solved it, or, as usual, a workover. If you've got any kind of work-related problem, my job here at KALW is to try to help you. But here are some of the things that have helped. Think of this as a buffet. You know, maybe one item you'll like, maybe not the rest. First thing is it possible? Sometimes it is possible to jigger your job description. Let's say you're better at managing people than data. Is there a way you could change your job description, if only modestly, maybe trade what you do with somebody else? Is your job just too great a misfit? I had a client who was a school psychologist, and she came home exhausted every day because she found herself not caring enough about special ed kids. And so she left school psych to become a coach to menopausal women, and now she almost never feels drained after the workday. Actually, her work actually energizes her. Are you being perhaps unreasonably intolerant of somebody? We all wish we could change readily, but we don't change that easily. For example, I know that I had a client who just seethed every time she saw a more competent coworker, even tried to sabotage her, something she admitted to me privately. On the other hand, there are some employees that are just too intolerant of a weaker coworker. And I know it's much easier said than done, but if you can't do anything about such a person, is it time to try at least to replace your anger, your enmity with, I know this is corny, I won't hate to say it, but it's a reasonable thing to aspire to replace some of that enmity with gratitude that you are more competent. In the same way as if you had a developmentally disabled child, you wouldn't be resentful of them when they were not performing the way you would like, although we're all human and sometimes we are. But at least it's sometimes wise to think of that coworker as somebody who does have a limitation, a mental or a physical limitation, and trying to invoke that tolerant side that we all claim how tolerant we are. Do you need a general, more broad attitude change? For example, some people's unconscious mindset is to do as little work as possible. Those people get stressed when they have to do more than the minimum, or they get frustrated when something takes more work than they thought it would take. Would it help for you to think that maybe much of your life's meaning lies in how much you have produced, and so your goal should be to be as productive as possible, not do the least you can get away with? Do you need to manage your time better? For example, are you spending too much time on tasks that you'll find fun, but that aren't that important or don't need to be done so perfectionistically? I had a client who just loved polishing up her papers that were, you know, to be handed out at meetings, and they were beautifully done. But she ended up spending so much time at that she was, you know, rushing with everything else and not getting other things done that were more important. It's tempting for all of us to do what we find more fun. But as part of your exhaustion that you're so racing to catch up with stuff because you were spending time on other things that were less important, that you become exhausted. And again, just kind of reiterating this exhaustion point, you know, being intolerant, being frustrated is exhausting. I think, for example, of the school psychologist who was just very frustrated with special ed kids. You know, and so she became that coach to menopausal women and found herself not exhausted at the end of the workday. How about delegating? Now, most people, when I tell my clients, you know, are you delegating enough? They don't have anybody to delegate to. Well, sometimes there's an answer in an intern. Now, I personally find really sad that how many nonprofits and companies and government agencies are using volunteer interns to avoid paying people even minimum wage. But it is the law, and at least I raise for your consideration, if you don't have anybody to delegate to, but you're getting exhausted after work because you're just too much to do, should you get permission to hire someone if you can, but recruit a volunteer intern if you can't? Maybe you're one of those people who gets exhausted because you just don't even know where the time goes. I mean, I'm a little reluctant to mention this because it's so onerous. But at least for a day, should you be logging what you've done each of the previous, like, 15 minutes? So you have on your phone, there are timers, or just on your watch that you wear around your wrist. Set it for going off every 15 minutes and simply on a memo pad or a notepad in your phone or on your computer, write down what you did during the last 15 minutes, just a phrase. And then at the end of the day, ask yourself whether you're not being using your time well. Because if you can cut out some stuff, or you can do things less perfectionistically, or you can delegate, then you're not going to be racing and exhausted. Exhaustion comes in part from rushing too much. Sometimes people aren't sure how to be more efficient. If that's you, maybe you should have a coworker or an outside career coach, or if just anybody you know who's efficient. I mean, I've had employees, one of my clients, have me come and spend an hour with them watching them at work, give you some feedback. Should you ask that person how she would tackle a specific time-consuming task that you frequently have to do? Let's say you always have to write these reports. You know, ask her what he or she might do that might get it done well enough, but more quickly. Is part of your exhaustion coming from you just need to manage a supervisee better? Do you need to do a better job of training the person? You would hope that they could do the job, hit the job running, but sometimes they do, but sometimes you haven't hired that kind of person. So is it worth the short-term time that it might take to slowly, patiently train or retrain that person so in the long term you've got more time on your hands, you're not so racing and rushing? Do you need to give a person, sometimes it's not more supervision, sometimes it's less. Sometimes, you know, you feel like, you know, that your job as a manager is to supervise, have them report all the time. But sometimes less supervision is better. And it doesn't have to be enough to treat every one of your supervisees the same way. There are some who you know are pretty good at being autonomous and would welcome, like, the freedom of not having you micromanage or even manage much, but just being there on an as-needed basis. So if you're telling those kind of supervisees, you know, I really trust you, you're doing a great job, I don't feel the need for you to submit those regular accountability reports that I'm asking of some of the other people. If you need my help, I'm here, otherwise you're fine. Well, that's going to make you less exhausted, not just because of the time, because you're not spending all that time in management and supervision. That can be draining. What about your boss? Are you, for example, do you need to reset your relationship? Like, maybe you're very stressed every time you see the boss, and the boss has always seemed to give you a hard time, treating you less well than he or she does with other employees. Maybe it's time to try to ask for a reset, saying something like, I sense I'm not meeting your needs as well as I should. Is there anything you'd like me to do more of or less of? Something new? And my favorite question to ask is, how can I make your life easier? So if you can get a better relationship with your boss, you're going to feel less stressed and be less exhausted during the day. Or is it simply immutable? Are you and your boss like oil and water? You just don't mix. So, you know, the obvious way is to simply minimize the interaction. Sometimes some of my clients, as simple as it sounds, some of my clients, in an attempt to always fix the relationship with the boss, spent more time with them. Sometimes you need to just say, you know what, I can't leave this job. I can't change bosses, but I can certainly minimize my interaction with him or her. So I'm just going to try to be avoidant, maybe giving fewer of those status reports if you can. avoiding one-on-one meetings. Or maybe you might ask to telecommute for at least part of the week. Or, you know, the ultimate way to deal with a boss you can't deal with is a timely request to transfer. Or maybe you could ask your boss if you could have a different cubicle that's a little further away. Or request being assigned to a different project or a different boss. Or would you be wise to ask for a transfer or get a new job? Anyway, those are some of the more, you know, when people say they're exhausted after work, as I said, many of my clients started by saying, well, what I do is I meditate, I exercise, I smoke dope, I do whatever, I have a glass of wine. But those are symptomatic treatments, and I've tried to give you roughly a dozen of maybe more solutions that could be addressing the cause rather than the symptom of being exhausted at work. And so now I invite you to call in. Either you can agree, disagree, or amplify with any of these suggestions I've given, or you may be exhausted at work and don't think that any of those are going to solve your problem and would like a customized solution, or you simply want a workover. You have any kind of work-related problem and you'd like my help. I will do the best I can. The price is certainly right, as I like to say, zero, zippo, nada, here at Work with Marty Nemko and KELW, the phone number. For all of those reasons, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for your calls, I promised during the week that I would also share some of my favorite careers for word people. I'm kind of dividing careers up into different categories, but I'm not overly, I don't believe in the more micro dividing up of jobs into like the Myers-Briggs 16 categories, or because most careers really can't be that defined so precisely. So I kind of just do some basic breaking down of careers, and one is word careers. And those word careers can break down into two categories, writing careers and speaking careers. Before I get into that, though, I do want to give out the phone number one more time. If you are exhausted at work and either need some help or you are have a, just any kind of work-related problem and you'd like my input on how to make it better, I'd call them workovers. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So as I said, the careers for word people can be divided into two categories. One is writing careers. And certainly maybe the most, you know, so many writing jobs these days are volunteer gigs. I've said before on the show that even when I write for Time, I've written 20 essays for Time magazine's ideas section. And even though I'm not shy about negotiating, they insisted on paying me zero. And because I have this inexorable urge for creative self-expression, as do many people, I did it. But a lot of people would like to make a living as a writer. And your best shot at that is being what I call, and this is the umbrella term, an in-house writer. Sometimes they're called corporate communications or donor management or even public relations. So every large company of any size hires writers, companies, nonprofits, government agencies, to create catalog copy. Like, I love Trader Joe's, so, you know, and it comes in the mail, and it's also on the Trader Joe's website. There's something called a frequent flyer, and it's very cleverly written, mouth-watering descriptions of all the great products that are they're highlighting for the month. Like right now, it's October, so it's a lot of pumpkin stuff, and somebody's got to write that, and I guarantee you they're not being paid zero. You know, people get hired as in-house writers to do that. They may write public education articles. For example, the government, when there is a disaster, like at Puerto Rico, I'm sure that the local Puerto Rican government and the maybe FEMA, the federal government, is issuing various kinds of advisories. You know, what to do, how to sanitize your water, what to do to create a makeshift roof in the interim. Etc. There are jobs, believe me, that all levels of government hire writers to do that. Companies hire people to do investor relations, maybe write annual reports, maybe write employee manuals. You know, the employee manuals people don't read. Or press releases, endless press releases. Even sometimes, unfortunately, a lot of those press releases, I get a lot of them, are not exactly newsworthy. But companies, and I get them from nonprofits, and I get them from government, these press releases announcing the newest program, product, service, promotion, whatever, somebody is getting paid to do that. And nonprofits use writers all the time to write just simply donor thank you letters in hopes of getting more money, or donor solicitation, or speeches. You know, they hire writers to either write or edit the speeches that the bosses give either internally to the troops or externally to customers or donors, or for investments. You know, how many small businesses are trying to get my Series B or Series C round of venture funding or angel investor funding? Well, a lot of those pitches, like you see on Shark Tank, that TV show, you know, are scripted and then not read, hopefully, but then, you know, ad-libbed, or as in the case of politicians or newscasters, not me, nothing you're hearing here is scripted. But much of what you do see in newscasters and speeches, especially politicians, are read through a teleprompter. So that's a, you know, kind of a buffet of writing careers that actually might actually pay you something other than writing the great American novel or that blog, which a few years ago they said, yeah, that's a great way to establish your brand. But really, in this era where there's so many blogs and podcasts and the like, it's unlikely to happen. Anyway, I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem of any sort, the topic I led the show was with what it was exhaustion. So if you're exhausted at work or otherwise unhappy at work and are looking for some help, I do what I call workovers here at KLW and work with Marty Nemko. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Marty. I just want to thank you for the show. I listen to you every weekend as I travel to visit my parents.
Great.
And I just wanted to say I have one of those exhausting jobs. I'm a preschool teacher, mm-hmm. and I come home and I do have that, especially in the winter, feeling of, oh my God, I can't even, you know, lift a finger to do my email or
right.
any of that. And
right.
what's helped me has been walking in nature, like trying mm-hmm. to get a
me
little
too.
Walk in.
I love
and
doing
also,
that.
And also, yeah, I've been swimming in the ocean lately.
Ooh.
And that's been this huge boon
wow.
to my mood. And I went online and I Googled benefits to cold water swimming. And it really is beneficial to one's respiratory system, but also as a decompression or almost de-depressioning.
Right.
It lifts my energy and kind of gives me a reset. And so I just wanted to share that in case that's helpful for
yeah,
anyone out there with a similarly exhausting job.
Had you ever heard of those people, I think they're at Coney Island in New York, who in the middle of the frigid winters will go into the waters of Brooklyn Sound or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's also here we have the Polar Bear Club, and we swim year-round in the ocean in the San Francisco Bay, and it's not impossible to do, and it's certainly, you have to have a strong will, and for me it's psychological. I go in and I say, okay, this chaos that's in this ocean today is just like the chaos in my life, and I'm just going to stand it down. You know, it's kind of like it's some spiritual, you know, craziness. But I feel like it's really, there's some exemplary thing about the ocean and being able to go with the flow, so to speak. And I think that's probably what those folks in Coney Island
right.
experience.
You know what I think? This is almost like the modern day and maybe Bay Area centric replacement for religion. In years past, people would go to church or they would pray, they'd do their novenas or whatever. But the Pew Trust found that the fastest growing religion is no religion. Yet people have a need for something that is beyond the day to day and relief from stress and such. And for many people, it's nature. There aren't going to be a lot of polar bears out there, but there's certainly a lot of people, including me, who, frankly, because I am sitting all day, every day, night and evening, and I'm writing a book now again, my 10th. It's not, you know, they say that sitting is the new smoking. So I get up all the time, every hour, and I take a brief hike with my doggie, and once a day, we take a 45-minute, very vigorous hike, and it is cleansing. It is the new religion. What do you think about that?
I think it's really interesting that you bring that up, because I think it also answers the question about exhaustion at the end of the day. I have also attributed some kind of spiritual belief system in my work, and just that it's kind of my calling, and or that what I'm doing is helping the future. And when I'm totally exhausted and I'm looking at a child that's really driving me crazy, I literally imagine that they are somebody I know, but as a, you know, a baby. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that is my mother, or that is my father, or that is my best friend. And I'm not going to do what I really want to do, which is to just kind of push them into their place. I will gently coax them or distract them into their place. And so I think that this idea of spirituality as a non-religious daily practice in a church, or, you know, or being with nature, as sort of understanding that perhaps spirituality is greater than just idol worship and following the rules of some precept that was laid down by some power-hungry church or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I mean, I do think that here in California, we're free enough to be able to think outside the box. We're kind of known for that, and it's easier for us to do that transmutation, you know, to go from being Catholic or Jewish or Hindi or whatever, and just sort of stretch it out into devotional practice with nature, or yoga. I mean, so many people are very willing to carry their yoga mat around, and it's in India, it's the bindi on the forehead that tells you you're spiritual. Well, here it's people have taken spirituality and turned it into exercise, or turned it into materialistic job, you know, selling spirituality. I mean, it just seems like almost anything's up for grabs. But if one does harness the notions of gratitude, like you mentioned earlier in your show, or harness some of these spiritual precepts into one's daily life, it actually can help, I think.
That's what it's the daily life conversion. You know, I have more respect for the person who recognizes that even that while we're human and we're going to get upset at that kid who's driving us crazy, or that adult who's driving us crazy, but somewhere in the back of our brain, we're tempering that with this relative, this larger, this sense that we are not just in that moment of fury, but that there is a larger purpose. Even if we are an accounts payable clerk, if we're making sure that that person is getting paid on time, or even if you're a bureaucrat who's just doing, you know, stamping papers that need to be approved, ultimately, as long as the work is ethical, keeping that larger perspective, it doesn't require yoga or meditation or nature, but keeping that larger perspective is a really great balance, a little tempering of that fury that could occur, or depression or sadness that occurs in, because work ain't fun a lot of the time, and that can really help. Does that make sense?
I think you just wrapped this conversation right back around to the ocean.
There we go.
So I think going into the ocean, or standing at the, you know, doing something that makes you face the bigger nature of reality, and or, you know, the actual force of nature that's very real. I mean, it's not any figment of the imagination or magical thinking. It's like, this is happening right now, and you cannot, you know, I think artwork was the other thing I wanted to mention too. It's just, for me, playing my instrument at the end of the day is so relaxing, and it's something that I have to do. I mean, I have to literally say, okay, even if it's, I'm so tired, I have to put that strap on and throw that instrument around my neck and do it. It's once I get started, it turns into this the zone, you know, and that zone of concentration, or that zone of being away from the daily grind.
You know, these are all of a certain genre. I want to make the case, actually, for there's nothing wrong with allowing yourself watching some TV and playing video games, you know, doing mindless things. The most memorable thing I remember, my daughter was totally stressed out when she was in high school, and what she would do is when she came home, she sewed boxer shorts for her boyfriend. She just made one after another, and it was almost meditative. It's like when some people knit. Or doing something totally even passive or mindless is okay for a little while. Not, I mean, I see people who, you know, go way too far and they accomplish nothing in life, and that's what they mainly do, is literally, metaphorically, knit. But but as a little bit of recharging is certainly appropriate. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much for the show.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
And so if, as you see, I welcome comments, not just questions. So if you have a comment or a question about this issue of exhaustion at work, a suggestion, I always welcome suggestions, or you're struggling with any aspect of your work life, that's what I love to hear. That's what Work with Marty Nemco and KALW are about. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before I went to the phones, I was offering some careers for word people, and I talked about in-house writing. But there's a particular niche I want to focus on here, which is proposal writing. An ever larger percentage of gross domestic product, the GDP, is being distributed by the grant process, where governments put out something called an RFP, request for proposal. Also, nonprofits do that. Foundations will put out a request for proposal. And anybody who wants to get the grant, they're usually other nonprofits or smaller organizational groups, they write these proposals. And that is a great career because it is endlessly innovative. It is endlessly creative. You are not just sitting behind your desk writing, because you've got to be talking with your staff and other outsiders for what should go into the grant proposal. It's a great career, and for many people who have nonprofit sensibilities and government rather than private sector sensibilities, it's one of the best, it seems to me. And because you're bringing in money, again, every organization, whether it's for-profit or not-profit, their lifeblood is money. And so if you're bringing in the money, that's going to increase the chances of you getting paid reasonably well. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco if you want to work over any kind of work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another kind of career for word people that is, I think, particularly well-suited to the Bay Area and the KALW, we're very political here. Political writer. You're working for a candidate or a ballot initiative or a lobbying organization. You might write you might make slogans or create flyers or website copy or fundraising letters. Again, it's all about money, unfortunately. You might be, when you really reach the pinnacle of political writing, you're a speechwriter. I do want to actually say something about speechwriting. It's a real art. It's you're really having to certainly understand the content that the politician wants to make, but you've got to meld an undergirding values. I'm not doing such a good job of explaining this. Very often there's market research data that has to be incorporated because politicians say what people want to hear. And then you've got to write the speech in a style that is consonant with the politician's style. You know, are they more feeling-centric? Are they a no-nonsense, bullet list? What's the deal? Writing it so it is in their voice, listening to them. Can you picture them saying it? It's a very wonderful, interesting writing job. And again, it's not just politicians even. There are executives, for-profit and non-profit, who are always giving speeches that are very often carefully crafted. What makes some leaders great is not their writing ability, or they have some other kind of abilities. Maybe they've got a long list of fat cat friends that they know they can get money from, but they're not great public speakers. So being a political writer, whether it be for a politician or a ballot initiative or an organization, a lobbying organization, can be a very useful career. Website editor. Now, unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people who write articles generally can't make a living from their writing. The whole notion of citizen journalism, we're all so eager to make a difference and or to express ourselves that we are willing to write for nothing. And how many millions of people write reviews, for example, on Amazon, which I do all the time because it feels great to be able to share my real experience with a book or a product or whatever. But the problem is then, so there are most writers don't get paid much, if at all. But every publication, every major publication, whether it be a print publication or an online publication, needs at least one editor. Because that editor is core to the publication's success, and that can't usually be done on a part-time temp basis. That person's going to develop a vision for the publication that's going to attract enough loyal viewers or readers and maybe subscribers, maybe advertisers, that person's got to typically find those writers who are willing to produce quality articles or videos or whatever with minimal supervision and do it for little or no pay. That's just the reality. That editor may be an expert at search engine optimizing, or find a techie who is, because no matter how good the article is, unless it's going to come up on you on a Google search, it's not going to go anywhere. They also, you know, they may have, you know, they may not be a graphics person, but enough at least to be able to speak with a graphics person to create really cool visuals. We live in an ever more visual. They may need to work with a techie. So you can see that these editors have to do so much, and that's a really interesting job. You may do some writing. You may do some, you know, literal editing. So being an editor for a publication is great. Of course, you may have to start as a volunteer and then do the usual unfortunate schmooze thing to, you know, make connections with higher-ups so that you get to be the paid editor. Ghostwriter. That's another one. I'll give out the phone number again. You have a work-related problem? The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I like talking about ghostwriting. Of course, speechwriting is a kind of form of ghostwriting. But there's a lot of ghostwriting that gets done. Some people, like businesses, will say, you know, I have a client who's a famous, believe it or not, rock star. And he realizes that a lot of his fan base demands instant responses to social media posts. So he hires somebody for his Facebook, his Instagram, his Twitter, and that person is the ghostwriter. We don't think of that being a ghostwriter, but it absolutely occurs. What else? Of course, books. I mean, you know, so many people would like to have authored a book. Maybe it's for vanity, or maybe it's a memoir for their family, or maybe it's to enhance their career, to kind of make them seem more knowledgeable. Or they want to make a society. They have a view. You know, they want to dump Trump, and they want to write a book about dumping Trump. But they're not really great writers, or they want to market their business. You know, they got a business and they figure a lower key rather than advertisements that everybody, you know, looks askance at. They figure if they've got a book, it's going to make them seem like experts at their business. They're a plumber, you know, the ins and outs of plumbing or whatever. Somebody is a travel agent, but they specialize in the Bay Area, so they would like to have a book on traveling in the Bay Area, you know, or something like that. But they don't have the time or the expertise to write a book. Well, guess what? They hire ghostwriters. And the ghostwriter is going to interview the author, the quote author, or review their notes and turn it into a book. And usually, I don't know about usually, I don't know, Ken, I don't have the statistics, but the ghostwriter usually gets a with credit on the cover. I remember reading the autobiography of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and it's appropriately said it was by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar with Mignon McCarthy was the name, Mignon or Mignon McCarthy, but not always. And the most famous, of course, is Hillary Clinton, who not only didn't give a with, Hillary Clinton with Barbara Feinman, but she didn't give a with to any of her three books. And she got into trouble because one of them didn't fall in line. Barbara Feinman, who was at least for two of her, the ghostwriter for two of her books, she publicly was furious because Clinton didn't even acknowledge her in the acknowledgments. So it was like Hillary wanted to make it seem like she wrote her books and wouldn't even acknowledge Barbara Feinman in her acknowledgments. And Barbara Feinman made very public her feelings about Hillary because of that. But anyway, ghostwriting is certainly a rewarding career. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how I would, if I wanted to be a ghostwriter, what I would do to get one of those celebrity gigs, because these days, unfortunately, we live in such a celebrity culture that the books that sell mainly are written by celebrities. So, but if they're a really big-time celebrity, they're going to probably not want anything to do with me. They don't need, you know, Beyonce doesn't need me. But if there was some kind of a celebrity who maybe a year ago was celebrity and suddenly she's out of the headlines and would love to get resurrected, that kind of person might be open to having a autobiography written as a way of reincarnating her into the, recatapulting her into the stoplight or into the spotlight, or him, of course. So I would think about 2016's or early 2017's big stars who suddenly are nowhere to be seen now. Someone, they could be taking a vacation, they could get sick or whatever. But I would make a list of those, and of course they would only be people whom I respected. And I'm not, you know, somebody who would, I'm not like a Terry Gross who really likes performers. Much as I love music, I wouldn't want to write a book about performers. But, you know, I like public intellectuals. So I'd probably make a list of public intellectuals who did big stuff in 2016 or early 2017, but we haven't heard much from them now as we enter toward the end of 2017. And I would write a thoughtful letter, of course, well-written, but also making clear to that person or to their manager that I really understand, I've read a lot of their stuff, I know their work, here's why I appreciate it, and I'm a writer, and here are clips to my writing. This is not a career, by the way, for a beginner. A beginner is not going to get to be a ghostwriter for a celebrity. But I have been well published, so I would, even if you've only been published moderately, but if it's written in a style that might work well for somebody's memoir, I would send that thoughtful letter, including some clips, to, you know, probably 20, because the odds are that 19 of them will, 18 no responses, one rejection, and if I'm lucky, I'll get one yes. So, but, you know, and that important sub-message in that is, every successful person absolutely accepts that failure is the norm and no response is the norm. And they go in expecting, I'm going to need to send 20 inquiries if I expect to get one yes. And that's true of even me at this point. I'm now writing my 10th book. I've written 3,200 nationally published articles, and I still expect to have to send out 20 if I hope to get one yes. That's just the way of the world. And one of the defining differences between the successful and the unsuccessful is not whether they fail, it really is their resilience. Now, of course, you don't, you know, Emerson, some listener corrected me last time, Emerson, not Longfellow, said that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. You don't necessarily do the same thing 1,000 times and, you know, the same thing and expect a different result. So after 10 or 20 tries, it's not going anywhere, the successful person changes. They say, okay, what should I learn from this? Do I need to do a minor pivot of my goal? Do I need to do a major pivot? But the successful people do not wallow. That is absolutely true. They are continually taking that next baby step forward, for what it's worth. In any case, that was what I wanted to say about ghostwriting. I would contact these, you know, 20 of these of these just recent has-beens who would still like to resurrect a career, and yet they're recent enough that a book publisher might say this is still a celebrity. I think that would be a fun way to get a kind and go book ghostwriters. Celebrity book ghostwriters make good money, so I think that you would do fine. Not would, I can't say it. Depending, you've got a shot if you're a good writer at doing fine. Anyway, the phone number here for a workover, if you'd like, here on Work with Marty Nemko and KLW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Usually the lines are full. This is one of those rare times you can get on without having to wait a long time. 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Marty. Thanks so much for your show. Really like your perspective and really broad range of knowledge and comments. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I have a question about seasoned executive. Keep getting the question why I'm not on any social media, and I wanted to get your feedback on, number one, the value of social media. Number two, if you were going to dip your toe into the water, would you Instagram? Facebook seems like it has so much personal stuff on it. I don't think that's really appropriate. But I have this kind of, you know, in a work-life balance, I feel a split is, a line is needed between personal and professional. Is that just outmoded?
No, you certainly can. What's your field? Because I want to give you a customized answer rather than something generic.
Well, it's in R&D development, robotics.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Okay. Well, yes, you absolutely should, and it's not just because it's cool or it's in. There are forums on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the place you certainly should be. And it's not so much, even if you're not looking for a job, LinkedIn and Yahoo both have thousands of forums on every imaginable topics, including robotics, you can be sure. And joining those appropriate, and there's probably dozens of those robotics, but joining the one that, you know, there are people who specialize in 360-degree arms that would enable far more robotic arms that enable far more utility. They're that granular. So finding the one or more forums on LinkedIn, they call them LinkedIn groups and Yahoo groups, or LinkedIn forums, and joining those, and start by lurking, just looking at the threads, meaning the posts that people have made. You'll learn what people are thinking about and talking about, and problems that are getting solved. It's a lot of peer-to-peer support and advice giving. And they have links to the coolest things. There's no question that anybody, you know, should be on LinkedIn, who's in the game, should be on. And it doesn't take a lot of time. It could take 2 minutes. We're not asking you to devote a lot of effort to this. You go and you join the forum. It takes 30 seconds on LinkedIn or find the Yahoo groups. Then you simply, maybe once a week, you don't have to be sitting on it all the time, you glance. The other thing I really believe in is Twitter. For people who are there are two excellent purposes for Twitter. One is a repository of your own ideas. You know, every time I get a good idea that I think is a good idea that I want to share, I simply post it. And you have up to 140 characters, and sometimes they even let you do longer than that. And you've got this collection of all your ideas in one place. And eventually you get fellow followers. You invite people who are fellow robotics people to follow you. And that's a terrific thing. You can also follow people. You start normally, not by posting, but by following. So if you there's a search function on Twitter, and you simply search on robotics, or maybe whoever is the super poobah in your field, follow him or her, and you're going to get all kinds of knowledge and great information. That's the world's shortest course in social media for robotics, whether you're seasoned, highly seasoned, or lightly seasoned.
I appreciate that. I actually am, you know, pretty heavy into LinkedIn, and I really like that because, you know, it's strictly business. And then I look on Instagram or something
No,
to tell what is.
Forget Instagram. See, if you're talking, especially if you're talking about wanting to you know, have a line of demarcation between work and play, Instagram is playful. Right. It's social. It's very visual. It's lots of photos, a lot of cat photos. And, right. You know, and beach right. photos and stuff like that, and jewelry, and if you're worried about saving time, focus on Twitter. Follow some people. Don't post yet. Put the names of some people who are rock stars in your robotics field and see if they're on right. Twitter. Follow them. See what they tweet. Then when you get a sense of what kind of things get tweeted, the nature and format, you also get exposed to new and cool ideas. And that can be done in just a few. I spend maybe 2 minutes a day total on social media, but I do it every day, and I'm always checking. And it's a really enriching part. It's a way, especially if you're quote seasoned. And by the way, I hate those kind of words because those are clearly marketing words. You know, you know, it's fine to say, you know, I've got 25 years of experience, but when you start to use these words, that makes you seem like you're a job seeker, and it's the same as right. like, you know, I'm a self-starter team player who delights in exceeding customer expectations. I like dynamic organizations. Yeah. That just makes everybody puke. So avoid those kind of words.
It's like reading a cereal box.
Yep, and the problem is both career coaches and resume writers who use this crappy language, and also software. All the resume software invites you to say you can just kind of, you know, copy and paste these clever little phrases, and every employer rolls their eyes. Every job seeker is best served by creating connection with their potential employer. Yes, you must show your substance, but you've got to reveal your real self in your real language. You hire a resume writer, and you're going to get that sterile, stultified, artificial BS language like seasoned.
Marty, can I ask you one last real quick question?
Yeah.
How do you handle getting... through social media, specifically LinkedIn, is my main experience. And one of the reasons I'm cautious about getting into the other ones is I'm constantly approached and asked questions and asked for input and asked for information, essentially asked for expertise that I get paid for. How do you handle that? I'm sure you get asked.
I do it two ways. First of all, I know this sounds so sanctimonious. I do consider it a privilege to give away free. I don't give a lot. I mean, it takes me a minute. I mean, after all these years I've been a career counselor, I read somebody something, and in 30 seconds or a minute, I write the best one or two sentence answer I can. And I feel it's a privilege. It's no big skin off my back. So I absolutely do it without expecting anything in return. It feels fine. I have no issues with it. The other way, though, I keep it from being crazy is when I get a request, I get all the constant requests to join my LinkedIn network. If I don't know them, or unless they've written a very personalized note to me as to why they really like my work or value me, I never accept an invitation from people I don't know. So that's what I do. And I don't bother with Instagram or Pinterest or any of that stuff. Because I also, because I write a lot, I absolutely do post everything I write automatically. It's part of my ritual. When my article is done, I post it to LinkedIn, to Facebook, and to Twitter. LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. Not everyone, because I don't want to overwhelm my person. Facebook is my personal site.
Right.
So I only, my very best things that I think that my general friends would want to read, or my video. I do make a lot of videos. I love making YouTube videos. So I post those, but I'm very conscious. Do I post this on LinkedIn? Do I post it on Twitter? I also do post to my blog, but it takes a second. Because once I've done it one time, it takes a second to just recopy it. So that's my world's shortest course in social media for the seasoned or unseasoned.
No kidding. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco. What kind of robots do you make?
It's all kinds of, it's R&D stuff, so most of it I can't talk about. Some of the government, bomb diffusing, with the hands, graspers, which are called hand defectors.
Right.
To prevent injuries for soldiers.
Right, absolutely. Bomb, drone things, and right. I saw a video of Boston Dynamics Company. They have something called Atlas.
Oh yeah.
That's going to replace a lot of soldiers in danger, in harm's way. I saw an amazing video of them in very uneven terrain in snow, and even getting pushed down and being able to right themselves. So is it true that the future of the military is going to be significantly robotic?
Yes, what it does is it will segment the tasks that humans will do. Keep humans away from the really dangerous stuff. These things are all possible. Not only incredible engineering, and the technology is moving so fast, but it's processing power that's also helping it. Most of those, a few of them are wireless now. And battery technology is moving forward. So this will all keep the humans away from those super dangerous situations.
Right.
We don't know what those situations are going to be. We know what they have been in the past, but there's going to be new ones that come up. That's why Boston is doing such a great job with the constant repositioning of the feet and the movement. It's not based on certain kind of terrain. Used to be a robot, rolled across a flat floor at a TED Talk, and everyone went, ooh.
I predict that the next big disaster where they're going to use robots is a bioterrorism attack. Or chemical terrorism, where they will release, a biovirus in an area, and there will be, of course, we don't want to put humans in there, even in suits. There will be robots cleaning up that crap to the extent that's possible. Does that sound right to you, or is that wrong?
No, I think that's absolutely right, and that is actually a use that robots are really suited for, because. Because they have these highly specialized robots, and that would be to go in and, shut something off or close something down or prevent any further damage. So they are working on those. I think a lot of people, when they think about robots, they start thinking that they're going to lose their job and things like that. And, you know, people have been, you know, companies have been replacing people's jobs with mechanisms, you know, for a very long time. These are just the latest wave of mechanisms, so I don't mean to minimize it, but there's so much to be learned. And, you know, you could get on, you know, on the internet and take Python courses for $100 and learn how to code robots now. So the accessibility is also broadening and increasing as a lot of the jobs are moving over towards mechanized. Yep. There's also always has to be what's called HMI, or human machine interface. A machine cannot ever totally run all on its own. So understanding the interface, the point of the interface, there's a lot of work to be done there and a lot of people to step into it.
Yeah. You know, something I've got to say, though, is, you know, I do worry they'll be needing people to design robots and create the interfaces, but I am worried that a lot of the repetitive jobs will be automated, and that I am worried about regular people who do not have the intellect, I'm being really straight here, the intellectual chops to be robotic designers. What is going to happen to the literally hundreds of millions of people who had relatively repetitive jobs and who are not going to be able to find significantly remunerative work? That said, I want to thank you, though. You know, I don't like a society which honors its musicians, and I'm a musician, I'm a professional pianist, but that focuses disproportionately on its performers, on its politicians, and on its athletes. It is guys like you, and women like you, who are creating technologies that will save lives. I think of every Vietnam vet. I was watching, of course, the Ken Burns Vietnam series, who lost their arms to a mine that was set in Vietnam, and that because of you and people like you, there won't be people who will have lost their limbs, and their families who will have suffered so much from seeing their loved one without a limb. So I want to just thank you very much.
You're welcome. Can I just say one comment? You said two comments. Number one about that people, you know, don't have the intellectual chops. And then you mentioned Vietnam, and the two went together in my head. There's a great quote in Platoon when the older soldier asks Charlie Sheen, the younger soldier, "What are you doing here in Vietnam?" He says, "Well, you know, I was at home and I was at college. I wasn't learning anything, and I figured, how come the rich kids get to stay home and all the poor kids go off to war?" And the older guy says, "Man, you got to be rich just to think like that." And it's a beautiful line, because now kids get to see what's possible. And before, they couldn't even imagine, like, going to college or something, because they never saw it. But now, with everything available on the internet and all of these different coding things, there's really accessibility, and I really hope it makes a difference at that early stage.
See, that is a huge thing. That, you know, the word disruptive and transformational get used all the time, but the era of the big, expensive campus education is going bye-bye. There is an ever more immersive, interactive, even holographic courses that are wonderful, that are on a just in, learned on a just-in-time basis, will enable people rich and poor. You can go to Udemy or Coursera or edX, and you can get you know, amazing courses, including those taught by Harvard and Yale professors and Berkeley professors, for next to nothing. And the only thing that's missing is the piece of paper. And eventually, it is my prediction that the United States federal government is going to be grant degrees based on completing a certain number of these courses. I think that is going to be a transformational change that will be very egalitarian and democratizing. Anyway, I want to thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
That's a great vision. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Hard to follow robots, but I just wanted to make a writing suggestion.
Great.
There are businesses most people don't think of. They're called localization businesses.
Absolutely.
They provide document and catalog translations for companies.
And not just translations, but I'll explain it just because I'm a talk show host, and you can tell me if I'm missing anything. Many times a particular book or technology or anything or product or service will be developed in the United States, for example. But then it's ready to be exported to all over the world, and it needs to be localized in its interface, not just the language, but there are certain cultural norms, being more licentious or less in Brazil than it might be here, in a more Catholic country or a Muslim country. And they hire these localization experts who are both experts at the language and the culture to translate that which is made in America so that it is locally acceptable to the local people. Does that summarize it pretty well?
Oh, not really. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
What I'm suggesting is not the translation of the words, but this is format proofing. And I proofread for a company. It pays reasonably well, $22 an hour. This was 14 years ago. And when most people think of proofreading, they're thinking of the content, but the format of the page needs to be corrected too. I proofed in Italian, French, and Portuguese. I know none of those languages. I read for format and spacing.
Well, you know what? You've given a good example of how that's a niche within it. But I happen to know localization pretty well because I had a client who owned a localization company, and mainly what they did was not just the language, I said, but the culture, not just of books, but of products. But anyway, I always appreciate your contributions. Thanks a lot for calling the show. I only have a couple minutes left. I was talking about Careers for Word People, and I feel I want to offer a couple of more. And this is one of my favorite little odd ones in the writing domain. As we get ever busier, and as the databases on dating websites get filled with millions more people, just like LinkedIn now has 300 million people on it, a lot of romantic prospects, they know they want to go online to meet somebody, but they're not really... They don't know themselves well enough to write a good profile, or they're too modest, or they're too boastful, or they're too inarticulate to present themselves accurately. Well, there's a great writing job, helping people to create dating site, you know, their profiles. You might even, you don't need great photos, but you might take pictures of the people and using your phone. You know, these days phones are amazing. That's a kind of an under-the-radar niche kind of writing. And I would be remiss if I didn't end this segment on careers for word people by talking at least a little bit about speaking careers. Of course, there's the teacher career. I won't take time to talk about that now. There's trainers, of course. You know, employers are hiring trainers to teach job-specific skills like software or how to be a good salesperson. I have a client who runs a sales training business and makes a fortune, really, training salespeople, mattress salespeople, car salespeople, new home salespeople. So training. Health insurers and government agencies are hiring trainers to educate patients. Of course, corporations and nonprofits, there is government-mandated harassment training, diversity training, workplace violence training. So training is a great, for a word person, no question. I mentioned spiritual leader. You know, it may not be religious so much, but there is many people still really seek an organization, not just walking in nature or being a polar bear swimming in the ocean, but there is still a need for spiritual leaders. I think that religion is dying or going down, especially, but I think that there will always be a need for a spiritual leader of a group. I don't quite know whether it be in Buddhism, whether no God is involved or whatever, or even secular humanism. I really think there's a need for atheists who are in some ways look at secular humanism. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Hey, the show is moving from the weekend, what's it doing in the world is a show about work doing on the weekend anyway, to a time that is more appropriate for a show about work, Thursdays at 7 p.m. when you may still be on the way home from work. I'm going to be taking a little time to plan what I hope is going to be some cool new things. I certainly hope you'll join my wife, Barbara Nemko, and me for the inaugural reincarnation of Work with Marty Nemko on November 2nd from 7 p.m. on to 8. From 7 to 8 p.m. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.